Sam, keeping it true, watching old movies so you don't have to. With the benefit of hindsight, we'll see where the movies truly awful, or did it change history? Good evening. And welcome back to the Benefit of Hindsight podcast, the movie podcast in which a father and son talk about movies that they watched together long ago. We give each movie a memory score and then re-watch the movie to see whether or not the movie is better or worse than we remember. And then we score the movie again. With me, as ever, is my son Sam. Good evening, Sam.
Good evening, Dad. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm good because work has finished, you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Finally.
I mean, if you listen to this and you know anything about our work, we love our work and we miss it deeply. But on the other hand, yeah, no work today. It's quite a nice day.
Yeah.
You know, it's how time is different when you're not at work. So there was a point today where I looked at my watch and I thought, oh, if this was a normal work day, I'd just be finishing. And I'd done so many more things. That came out wrong. But you know what I mean? Time works differently.
Yeah, that same thing happened to me, funny enough, yeah.
Yeah. Well, a couple of email updates for you moving forward. We have a winner to our question to win the Benefit of Hindsight podcast T-shirt. And the winner is Ryan, who comes all the way from Sioux Falls in the United States of America.
Wow.
Which we did not plan thinking about posting this thing off to him. But what... Well done, Ryan. We will get that T-shirt sorted out. You do need to send us your size, though, Ryan, because you didn't, and that's quite important, so we need to know. Yeah. And the question that we asked was, what's the first movie that we watched together at the cinema? And Sam, can you remember the answer? Or do you know?
Batman Begins.
It was Batman. No, it wasn't.
Wait, what?
That's not what Ryan said.
Oh.
Ryan was pretty confident that it was the Wallace and Gromit trilogy.
Ah, that's right, yeah.
Oh. Well, trilogy as it was then, soon to be a quintology, is that what they call it? Who knows?
Yeah.
Anyway, congratulations, Ryan. You were the first person out of many people who came and answered that question for us. So well done. We will get that T-shirt to you. We did have quite a lot of people answering the question. You were the first. So we will do another quiz competition to win a T-shirt, but we won't do that yet. We'll make sure that Ryan gets his first, and then we'll come back to that later. Ryan, as well as answering the question correctly, also has another question for us. And his question is, I think similar to one we've been asked before, but he was talking about the Easter eggs that we'd referenced in Chicken Run. And all the different crossovers there were. And Ryan said, if you could invent a crossover between two ideas or genres or universes in a movie, what would be the ideal crossover for you? I know we've had a conversation about whether Marvel and DC will ever crossover. So I think that's kind of what he's referring to. So what would be your favorite or your dream crossover?
I don't want to go really obvious. So I won't say Marvel DC again. I don't know. Lord of the Rings versus Harry Potter might be kind of stupid, but also fun at the same time.
Yeah, I think I'd like to see that. I think that would be a good one. Yeah, yeah. Lord of the Rings versus Harry Potter. Yeah, that would be a good one. I think people would pay to watch that. I think
that's unfortunately true, yeah.
I was thinking Star Trek, Star Wars. That's totally doable.
Ah, yeah.
So it would be cool if Captain Kirk got to take on Han Solo. I wonder who would win in a fight between Captain Kirk and Han Solo.
The answer to that apparently is the writer decides. So the writer wins. Just whoever's writing it at the point in time,
right?
They decide.
Right. So Captain Kirk then, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely, Captain Kirk. Yeah, I think Star Wars and Star Trek is one I would see. And I think plausible. I think that will happen at some point.
Yeah.
There's too much happening there for them not to stumble upon each other at some point in the vast, endless universe.
True.
So, well, thanks, Ryan. That's a good question. Do we have any other crossovers that we'd be interested in seeing? Wallace and Gromit in Cloverfield?
Yeah, no, I would watch that. Except the Cloverfield's animated as well.
Ah, that is true.
It's all just stop motion. Made of clay. I'd love that.
Yeah. Dan, you'd watch that, right? Cloverfield, Wallace and Gromit?
I might make it, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. But why not? That's a Indiana Jones and... Oh, I lost that one. Can't think of one. I was trying to think of another Batman. Adventurous. Indiana Jones and Batman would work. Indiana Jones and Star Wars. I mean, it's never going to happen.
Apparently that's happened.
Has it?
It's a comic thing, I think, yeah. Chewbacca, like, finds Indiana Jones or something.
Wow, I need to find that one.
Okay. I'll have to look that up.
Well, it's a good question, though, but I'm definitely going Star Trek, Star Wars, because I would pay a lot of money to see that, maybe an arm or something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe not an arm. Arms are quite useful.
Well, maybe.
A foot. Sam, by the way, for those of you who aren't seeing this, and by the way, there's only one person seeing it, and that's me, Sam is sporting a rather magnificent Santa Claus beard as we are having this conversation. So, yeah. So
it's very warm.
Well, I'm not surprised. Does Santa, like, grow it out? Do you think he has it all year?
I think it's magic. So I think as soon as he shaves it, it just comes back anyway.
Right. So it's like a magic beard.
Yeah, yeah.
Are we there's a movie in there. Santa's Magic Beard.
It's like by Obi-Wan's beard.
So basically what happens in Santa's Magic Beard is that one Christmas, just before Christmas, he shaves his beard off and it doesn't grow back.
Yeah. And nobody believes that it's him.
No, that's right. So he has to try and solve the problem of his beard. He can't grow a beard anymore. He can't convince anybody he's Santa because he doesn't have a beard. And so, yeah, Santa's beard, what happens?
Christmas is cancelled.
Christmas is cancelled. Santa doesn't have a beard. We could sell this.
Absolutely. We shouldn't put it on the podcast.
We shouldn't. I hear Will Ferrell is interested.
Oh, and okay.
The Rock will be in it somewhere as well.
Oh.
Okay. Well, maybe not The Rock then.
Okay. The Stone.
Emma Stone and Will Ferrell.
Yeah, that's right.
It's perfect. Okay, if you're listening, Will, and or anybody in Hollywood, Santa's Beard, starring Will Ferrell and Emma Stone. Excellent. Well, that's one to look forward to for next year. So we went away and we watched the 2009 Spike Jones classic from 2009, Where the Wild Things Are, which I think I gave a 4 to. And what did you give it?
I gave it a 6, but I'm not sure that was very accurate.
Do you want to change your memory score, or is that against the rules of the podcast?
It could be against the rules, but let's say I said 6 last week, but in reality it's probably also about a 4 as well, from memory.
Okay. All right. Well, why don't we just agree that it got 10 out of 10 combined score. And so if you were to sort of go somewhere in between and give it a 5, for example, then it's still 9 out of 10. But yeah, you gave it 6, yeah. I gave it 4. And you're not sure about your memory score because you'd forgotten the movie, or are we going to get onto that?
Just because I think I had the wrong reasons last week to explain why I gave it that score. I think I was wrong.
Okay. That's unusual for you. You're almost never wrong.
That's not true.
No, you're right. It's not true. How ironic. So, based on the fact that your memory score is changing, does that mean that your rewatch score will change as well?
Yes, absolutely, yeah.
Okay. I always kick off with the wrong question. Because the question I ask is sort of the big question that everybody asks, or it's the most obvious question. But maybe I'll start with a statement that we can develop then. At the end of this movie, watching it again, I was completely uncertain whether or not I had just watched a modern masterpiece or something else.
Right. And
what do you think?
I think I'm on the same page as you. I think as soon as I started to watch it, I sort of clicked and realised this is an adult Sam film. Yeah. This is the kind of film I would sit down and watch, not to watch some big action movie, but to watch something that makes you think and makes you feel. Whereas back then when I'd watched it, which is why I think my score was wrong, is I don't think that was a very kid-friendly film. I think I went into it expecting the book that it's based on and came out going, well, that was dull. But as an adult, it's not dull at all. It actually spoke to me and makes perfect sense. It was a bit of like an epiphany sort of moment.
But it's not a kids' film, is it? That's the thing that I take away from it. It's an adult film or a film for adults based on a kid's book. Because the book the book's really simple.
Yeah.
In the book, he's in his bedroom because he's been told off and gone to bed without any supper. His bedroom turns into a forest. He goes over the sea, meets the nice people, becomes the king, and leaves. That's it. It's basically the book.
Right.
And then everything else sort of has that idea developed. So what would be the main thing that as an adult you found watching this movie that you didn't get when you were a child?
I don't know. I feel like it's more of an artsy take on the kind of thing, so it's not a kids film, as we've kind of already said. I think that I'm ruining my trivia, but one of the bits of trivia was that Spike Jonze didn't want it to be a cartoon because he wanted it to feel a bit more grounded and real. And I think it is sort of, it's hard to explain, but the realism and the actual live action sense of it sort of sells it to an adult as an actual story and reminding them of childhood innocence and wanting to have that freedom of being a child again. And I think as a kid, you don't feel that way towards this film because it's just a bit of a weird film. But as a grown-up, you recognise that, oh, I have grown up and I don't want to grow up. I don't know. That's just the way I came out of it, yeah.
I think that's partly what the film was about, isn't it? It's about sort of, I mean, it's an obvious thing to say, it's about loss of innocence. So Max gets there, he loses innocence, he comes back. And that seems to be what it's about. You mentioned the live action thing. I did think that the combination of the actors and the puppeteers in their costumes and the fairly minimal CGI was magnificently good, particularly the kind of puppetry and the artistry behind those things. Amazing. Really, really good.
It was very well done, and it almost felt like the characters were taken directly from the page in a reimagination of being real. And I think it, without that element to it, it wouldn't sell it at all. And you can tell that there's CGI in the face, which is really good, because if it was just full-on puppeteering, it wouldn't feel real. But as soon as you're introduced to all of these characters, it's like, okay, we've stepped into a completely fake world, but it's convincing. I think one of my notes was, it's a good pairing of imagination and suspension of disbelief. As an audience, you have to watch it and become a part of that world as if it's completely normal with no explanation. And it just, it does that. It works perfectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. Yeah, absolutely. And I did think that the sort of cast as well were really well suited to each of the individual monsters that they were playing. I thought the casting was pretty decent. I mean, I would have struggled to know that it was James Gandolfini in there if I hadn't looked that up. And there are a few other people sort of who I know of, Forest Whitaker, Catherine O'Hara, but no, they were great. They were really, really good. Everything they did about it was just really nice.
It was very well done. I didn't realize Mark Ruffalo was in it.
No, I'd forgotten. He was very briefly in it, wasn't he?
It's like a bit of a cameo.
Yeah, it's like there at the beginning. There's a bit at the beginning of the film where you just think Max is a bit annoying.
Yeah, true.
Hard to explain what I mean by that, but like you're not sure whether you're being directed to have sympathy for Max or sympathy for his mum. And because there's the thing with the snowball fight where you do feel sorry for him, and then his reaction to that, you think, well, okay, but I'm not sure whether I feel sorry for you anymore.
Yeah.
I wasn't really convinced.
There was like a weird's not the right word, but I really liked the chemistry between Max and his mum in the scene where she's on the phone about her job.
Mm-hmm.
And it just sort of feels like a weird, like she should be comforting him, but he's comforting her at that age.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was like, you don't really see that sort of acting and that kind of skill in storytelling. And I really appreciated that too. And I think that also spoke to adult Sam in a way.
Yeah. Well, we've talked about child actors before, and we've mentioned, you know, that they can be a bit hit and miss. But I thought the actor who played Max, who, by the way, is called Max.
Yeah.
I thought he was amazingly good. Really good.
Yeah, incredibly convincing, I thought, yeah.
I mean, he carries the whole thing. And, you know, I mean, okay, you've got the brilliant way in which it's photographed and you've got the really good puppetry and then and everything else. But he sort of carries the whole film through and is utterly convincing in it.
I think that works as well. I think just having a young actor who can come in, and I know it's an easy role to play for a kid, really, but I think in that sort of sense he sells it as well. But it was convincing the whole time, and you could feel the emotion in him when he's scared and when he's getting involved, and even the imagination of him coming up with ideas to sort of justify his presence to all of the wild things. I just think it worked perfectly. Like, you could see, it could almost be like a true story where he's improvising this as he goes, and it's obviously not, but it just worked really well.
But I mentioned he sort of carries the whole film, and he does, but
yeah.
But his range, you know, at the time the film was being made, he's 12 years old, and he's just got this enormously impressive emotional range where, you know, with a lesser actor, it could have been horrible, but it worked really, really well.
What did you think of the music?
I liked the music. I think it was, I think it really added something to the movie. I liked the fact that there was almost like a dual soundtrack. There were songs in the movie that worked really, really well. And then there was the kind of more soundtracky soundtrack. But I think it would probably be the kind of soundtrack that if you sat and listened to on its own without the movie, you would probably still enjoy. So I don't know whether or not you enjoyed it, but I thought it was a really, really good soundtrack. And I thought the songs in the soundtrack were really good as well.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's got a great score and a great soundtrack. And I think the blend of having actual music and songs in there sort of really worked, but also really sold the sort of artistic indie film kind of look at it. And I thought the choices of song were perfect, and it is the kind of music that you would just listen to just to relax and have on in the background. And I really liked that, and I also just like how the score sort of underlined the imagination of it all and also the intensity at certain scenes. So I think it all just worked perfectly well together. Absolutely.
The guy who did the soundtrack, his name is Carter Burwell, and he is very well known for making really, really good soundtracks. And one of them, one of my favourite soundtracks in one of my favourite movies is Fargo. And I didn't know that he was the guy that did Fargo. He's done lots of kind of things with the Coen brothers, The Big Lebowski and things like that. He did Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which was a good soundtrack. And he's done lots and lots of kind of really good movie soundtracks for, I don't know how you describe them. You wouldn't call them independent filmmakers, but not necessarily the big studio filmmakers. So yeah, there's some really, really good ones in there. He's clearly a guy that knows what he's doing, and I think that works. He's made lots of soundtracks for Spike Jones, Jonesy before as well.
Yeah, I think he did a great job.
It was, I think, one of the strengths of the movie was the soundtrack. And by the way, I mean, you talk about like the director Spike, and some of the films. You know, it's a really interesting choice to make this movie if you are the director. But he has made some, like, you know, some really good movies. You know, his filmography as a director is, you know, he did Being John Malkovich, Adaptation. He's done some, they're good movies. And so it seems like a really odd choice to take this on, but I guess it kind of makes sense, really.
Yeah. I've seen Adaptation.
It's a good film,
I
right?
I watched it at uni.
No, yeah. It's a really, really
don't
good film.
Much.
He was also directed he's done a lot of music videos. As I say, pop videos.
Yeah.
They're not really called those anymore. But I mean, he did things. He's done things with the Beastie Boys and things like that. So, yeah, he's obviously a good filmmaker.
Yeah, I think it's probably, I don't know, I would say it's a good thing that he did this film, because I feel like a lot of it could have been a big studio thing that was animated and big high budget and sent to the world and Happy Meal toys and things like that. Whereas I think it works better like this, but only as adult Sam saying that, kid Sam would say different.
Well, I think there's an alternate universe where the Wild Things are has been made into a perfectly lovely, happy family movie. Because essentially what this is a movie about five or six neurotic monsters that live on an island and don't seem to be able to get along with each other. And when they do get along with each other, everything's lovely. But for the most part, they all have issues and they're very neurotic and things. And it's just so delightfully weird that this movie even exists.
I know, and I love it.
Yeah. At the beginning of this podcast, I asked the question, I wasn't sure whether it was a modern masterpiece or something else. So let's have a look at the something else for a moment, because it doesn't necessarily move at the fastest pace, does it?
No, true.
It does sag a bit in the middle. And there's quite a lot of time where you're thinking, okay, and I'm not really sure what this movie is about, but I'm going to go along with the building of a fort idea. That's quite good. But then that's never really explained why that happens. And there was
it doesn't look anything like the idea.
No. And I did, there was a period about halfway through the movie where I thought either this is a really bad movie or I'm just very confused and this movie is not for me, because I did find parts of it painfully slow, for what it's worth. What would you think about that?
I don't know. I feel like there is probably a deeper message or meaning in it, but it didn't quite come across. But at the same time, I think I just enjoyed the idea of it and the teamwork side of it and how everything was going to work together. I think it's one of those montage-y scenes where either you're sick of it and it's boring or it just works. So that kind of came across to me in that way, but I can totally see where you're coming from, yeah.
I just wonder if during those moments, I was thinking, I'm not a sophisticated movie viewer. I'm missing it. I could see that it was beautifully photographed. I could see that it was well acted, beautifully scored. And I was thinking, this is not the film's problem. It's my problem. I'm missing something here. And I'm not sure if that's whether or not I'm being too hard on myself. I don't know. But I was conflicted during the movie, because there were times when I was just thinking it was as boring as I remembered it being in the cinema. I'll say that.
Right. Okay. It's one of those things where a sort of an indie independent type movie I have to be in the right mood for. Like I watched one a couple of weeks ago and I wasn't expecting it to be what it was and I couldn't get into it. And I think if I was in the right mood, I could totally enjoy it. And I think for the most part, the majority of watching Where the Wild Things Are, I was in that sort of mood. So I think part of me just sort of, gelled with it and got on with it and enjoyed it. I think if I wasn't in that headspace of what I'm watching and what I want to watch, I wouldn't have enjoyed it as much as I did that time around. But I think because I was in that mood for a film like that, it was okay. And I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
It makes all the sense in the world. I think this is a mood movie, I think if this movie struck you when you are feeling nostalgic or perhaps even a little, sad is probably not the word I'm looking for, but I think there'd be a point where you could watch this
melancholy
movie. Melancholy. Yes, melancholy is exactly the word.
Yeah.
If you were feeling melancholy and you watch this movie, it would be much more impactful.
Yeah, it's like a resonate kind of thing.
Yeah, it would resonate very, very differently. It wasn't a huge commercial success. It cost $100 million to make, and it made $100 million. So now I never know when they do that whether or not they count all the marketing costs in that $100 million or not, because it wasn't a massive commercial success. It basically cut even.
Yeah, one of my bits of trivia was about that, but it did debut at number one at the box office, but just never broke even. Yeah,
and it wasn't necessarily a kind of critical success in terms of, you know, we always talk about Academy Awards and things. It wasn't really nominated for anything. It had a couple of kind of Saturn Awards and things like that, and there were some where, you know, for example, the Chicago Film Critics Association, which is actually quite a big deal, nominated it for Best Picture. It got a couple of nominations for Best Original Score, one from the Golden Globes and things like that. But no, it never really got any further than that. It just was. I think you either got it or you didn't. And it feels to feels to me like a lot of people didn't get it. Is what I would probably say.
Yeah.
Do you have any exciting trivia and or out of pocket takes about this movie? I'm sure you do.
I don't know about the word exciting. No.
Fair enough.
That's as well as that went. Yeah. Apparently, I think I already mentioned this, but Spike Jonze had obviously turned down the chance to make it animated, but apparently it was because he wanted people to feel the wild things and thought it would be more exciting and dangerous if a real kid was running around with the wild things, right. Which I totally agree with. And I think that, I mean, it's as soon as he's introduced to them, and he sees them from the distance, you can feel that danger and it's confusing and what's going on. And to have him in those sort of areas, even when he's being chased, I think that really sells it. And I think it would be lost if it was animated. So I completely agree with that choice.
Yeah. No, I agree completely. And as we often do and often say, I think the fact that they are not animated and they are so real, they're not even all just CGI. I mean, they're made by the Henson. Yeah. They're made by the Henson Company, who, you know, if you're gonna make a movie where you need puppets, they're probably the go-to people for that. But they were just they were just utterly convincing. And I think, you know, that definitely, you see, this is a point I was going to make earlier and I forgot. That definitely helps a young child actor if they're acting against something that's in front of them rather than a tennis ball on a stick. And I think you could have totally told the difference.
Yeah, absolutely.
And because, you know, there's something real that you can then interact with. And even all the things like the eyes and the mouth and the facial expressions and things, not all of that is CGI. Some of that's just really clever kind of high-tech puppetry wizardry and things like that. Yeah. It was
convincing that you can't see the strings, so to speak, as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The book won an award, actually. I was going to mention the fact that the book won an award. It won BBC Culture best children's book of all time. I think it was 2019 when it won that, but it was voted by BBC Culture as the best children's book of all time.
It's one of those things like where a timeless book like that being left as a record historically, I would also argue that the film should be left as a historical record and put somewhere as some sort of, this is actually a good film that wasn't well received to begin with, but it has meaning. That's where I'd put it personally. You can see where my score's going here, can't you?
I really can. Yeah, I sort of feel like I can. It wasn't, as we said, it wasn't necessarily a kind of massive success commercially, but it really did have a really high critical response. I mean, you know, it was described by somebody in Entertainment Weekly as one of the year's best. Somebody in the New York Times said it exceeded anything that Spike Jonze had ever done before. The Roger Ebert said that he said for all the money spent, the film's success is best measured by its simplicity. And so it was, the critics absolutely loved it. And as often happens when the critics love a thing, it was pretty obvious that the movie going public did not.
Yeah.
Why? Well, interesting. There's never really explained why the monsters are unhappy.
No, that's a good point. Yeah, you just sort of assume. What if it's like one of those deep meanings, like a Toy Story type thing, where it's because they're grown up, they can't feel it anymore.
I think when I was thinking about that idea, why is all the adults unhappy? If you think about what's happening to his mother, she's also an unhappy adult. And I just wonder if that's a kind of a thread through the film, that being an adult is really, really difficult. And being a child is supposed to be easy, but it's also really difficult because you're always surrounded by it's sort of the joy of childhood is sucked out of you by unhappy adults. And again, you know, that's one of the things where you kind of have to go away and think about it. And, you know, when you watch the movie, you don't really question it until afterwards. But yeah,
true. I think one of the things as well is that I was expecting some sort of explanation, so to speak, maybe visually, about each of the wild things. Maybe there are an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
So one of them's depression, one of them's sort of stress and different things like that, anxiety maybe. But that never really happened. And I thought that might explain it all, but it never did. They all either had this, like, they didn't have a separate personality between themselves. They were all very similar.
Right. The director, Spike Jonze Jones, Jonzy, he said that his goal was to make a film that was about childhood and not create a children's movie. And
that was my next bit of trivia.
Interesting. And the guy who wrote the book, Morris Sendak, he loved it. He said, his quote is, "I've never seen a movie that looked or felt like this. It's personal. The director isn't afraid of himself. He's a real artist, and that comes through in the work. So he's touched me. He's touched me very much." And that was the guy who wrote the book. Not sure if he meant that last bit literally. I think he meant sort of emotionally touched.
Yeah.
But it is definitely not a children's movie. It's a film about children, but it's not a children's movie. And I think that's probably the point that we missed when we went and watched it.
Yeah, I think that's why I didn't enjoy it so much as a kid, but Adult Sam liked it a lot.
Do you know there was
spoilers for Mascal?
There was a video game based on the film.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's available. It was available for the PlayStation 3, the Xbox 360, the Wii, and the Nintendo DS.
Nice.
So there you go.
Might have to look into that one.
I'd say that's definitely one. It's definitely one you might want to look into. It wasn't a big hit, I have to say, the video game.
I can imagine.
But it did get quite low scores. I've just had a little look at that, but there you go. There must be many more things you want to say about Where the Wild Things Are, so I'm going to hand this over to you for a moment.
Okay. Just my last bit of trivia, really. To make the set more comfortable as an environment for Max, Spike Jonze encouraged the crew members to bring their children to the set, and some of them are actually in the classroom scene, which I thought was quite interesting, but also just another sort of very well done director move, if you want, where he's gone, we need to make it a safe environment for a kid who can just explore and have fun. And I think without that, you could probably tell that the actor Max wasn't too into it, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if he didn't have those children surrounding him, it might not have given as much a good performance. I don't know.
Wow. Do you know that Warner Brothers were really unhappy with this movie, apparently?
Right.
I think that like a lot of people, they were expecting to get back from Spike Jonze a really nice, fluffy kids movie. And they were really, really unhappy with it.
I'm not surprised.
In fact, they wanted to reshoot the whole thing.
We're going to reshoot
the whole thing. And eventually, they decided we can't spend any more money. They gave the director a little bit more money and some notes, and he had to go away and make a few. They made a few compromises, I guess. There you go.
You know that Tom Hanks produced this?
I did notice that Tom Hanks was involved in this. Yeah, I did notice that.
I'm shocked.
I thought that was quite interesting. Yeah, I wasn't necessarily shocked. I don't know, because it felt like the kind of thing that Tom Hanks might have been interested in. As a sort of in the background creative person. I don't know. I did see that he was briefly involved in it. There you go.
I just want to say the Hi Richard might be my favourite part. Where he gets eaten and there's the raccoon. Hi Richard.
Hi Richard. I did like that.
Yeah, it's just so well done. Yeah.
I enjoyed the dog, which just appeared from nowhere for no reason whatsoever. And don't be nice to it or don't give it food because it'll just follow you around. And I also found the monster. I think they called it Bull because it looks like a cow. Is that the one? For some reason, I found that was my favorite one. That was my favorite monster in the whole thing.
I really liked Bob and Terry.
Bob and Terry were also very funny. But yeah, if I had to choose my favourite monster, it would be Bull, because he was just the saddest thing I've ever seen. So there you go.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to go with scores for this movie. And you went first. So, you chose the movie, so you have to go first with your score. And by the way, I think your score may have a significant influence on mine, for what it's worth.
Right. So interesting.
So you gave it 6 out of 10, and let's see where you're going.
6 with an asterisk, because I don't think I was quite right, but we'll go with 6. I think I really enjoyed watching it this time around, and as I've mentioned a few times, this is definitely more of an adult Sam film. I think it's probably, out of all the ones that we've watched for the podcast, I think this is probably one of the best films that I've rewatched from my childhood, in the sense that I understand it more as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
I do think the film's kind of insane, but in a good way, and I think the storytelling aspect and the creation of it and the music and all of it, it's just, I really like it. And I'm glad that I have had the chance to rewatch it. So saying that, I'm going to change my score, shockingly, to an 8 out of 10.
Okay, 8 out of 10. Well, okay. I gave it 4 because I think you and I went to see it, assumed that it would be a children's movie, and it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, it didn't land with us. I'm going to give it... Okay, before I give it a score, I'm going to explain, because I can't help myself, a little bit more. Okay? So I think if this film finished 10 minutes before it finished, I'd be given it a really low score. Okay?
Oh.
Okay. I there were bits of it. I didn't feel sophisticated enough to get it. I knew what it was trying to do, but I didn't get it. But the last 10, 15 minutes or so, particularly when Max is saying goodbye to the monsters and the monster is wading out into the sea to say goodbye and he's too late. So there's no moment of physical connection between them. He just sails off and, you know, the monster turns into a dot in the sea. I just thought that was so desperately, desperately sad and deeply, deeply moving. This idea that there was no time to say goodbye, but it was... You know, it was the monster's fault because he was off, you know, I don't know, sort of not sulking or even, that's not even fair. But I thought the last 10 or 15 minutes of it was so good, so beautifully made that I can't give it a low score. I'm going to go with you. I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. I'm going to go up quite a lot. You see, the thing is, though, I could give it 10 because it's clearly a masterpiece. Okay.
Yeah, I almost did too.
But I also feel like I could give it 1 because there was about halfway through I was thinking, I'm like, it's never going to end. I don't know what's happening and it's never going to end. So I think 8 is fair because I don't want to give it 1 because it's way better than that. And I think it probably is a 10 out of 10 critically.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I'm going to go with 8. There we go. Hope that all makes sense. It was quite long.
It did, yeah. I feel like it's one of those films where upon each rewatch, it would just fluctuate all the time. Yeah.
I think it would be perfectly possible to watch it again and give it a 10 and call it your favourite film of all time ever. And there would definitely be people that would watch it and think, why have you given this 10? It's rubbish. It's 0 from start to finish. It is a very divisive thing like that. But I think if we both give it 8, I think that's fair. I think that's definitely... an emotional watch, right?
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
Let's go with one word review. What's your one word review of Where the Wild Things Are?
I don't know. I'm gonna go with creative.
Okay, I'm gonna go with a word that I'm gonna steal from you earlier, which is melancholy.
Oh, fair enough, yeah.
Because it definitely is creative melancholy. I think that sums the movie up beautifully. Excellent.
I like that, yeah.
Creative melancholy. Regular listeners of our podcast will know that we're not going to choose a rewatch movie. In fact, we're going to be the benefit of foresight for the next couple of days, because what we're going to do instead is we're going to go away and we're going to watch the new Wallace and Gromit movie, which comes out very soon, Vengeance Most Foul. And I'm sure we're both very much looking forward to it. So instead of talking about our memory of the movie, we're going to talk about our expectations of it and then give it a score and see whether or not we were right. Ta-da, it's a brilliant idea. So you go first. You go first. You are the Wallace and Gromit expert. You're the aficionado. You go first. What are your expectations and what score would you expect to be given it?
Firstly, why do I feel like Gromit's going to die?
No.
They can't. Not possible.
They can't do that.
But it looks like it.
I know. No.
That's just, imagine?
That's just for the trailer. Can you imagine if they did that, though?
On Christmas Day.
Well, I think we can be confident they aren't, because one of the directors, not Nick Park, the other one, whose name I can't remember, I'm really sorry, he said there's definitely more Wallace and Gromit movies to come. Just be patient with us.
Okay.
Just be patient with us. They take quite a long time. But that's can you imagine if they killed off Gromit?
I'd never recover.
The next one was just called Wallace.
Wallace and.
Yeah. No, I don't think.
No, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's time for a new one, definitely. And I think the story that they're clearly trying to tell is very modern, very, what's the right word? Very present. That's not the right word. It's right for the times, I think.
Current.
That's a better word, yeah. I like the idea that they're bringing feathers back. So I am absolutely looking forward to it, especially with the advancement in stop motion animation. You can already tell from the little trailers and things like that. So I think it's going to be another good one for adults, Sam, I think, as well as the little child in me that's going to just enjoy it. So I think based on that, I mean, I can't not give it a 10 as my expectations, right?
Right. No.
But then it can only go down at that point.
Yeah, it's a worrying thing, that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think part of me is also quite worried about Ben Whitehead as Wallace. I think I'm going to notice that it's not Peter Sallis, but I think from what I've heard and what I've seen already, he's definitely a good replacement for him. I don't know, maybe I'll give it a 9 just to play it safe.
Okay, all right. Okay, I tell you what I am surprised about, that the first Wallace and Gromit movie is actually 1989, so it's 35 years of Wallace and Gromit. It's extraordinary. So I feel very much the same way that you do. I'm very excited. And so it's obviously going to be a 10. But if I give it a 10 and then it isn't a 10, we then have to give the Wallace and Gromit movie less than 10, which I think that's against the law.
It might be.
For this podcast, I think that would be ultimately like against the law. So I'm going to plan for the crushing disappointment of over expectation, and I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10.
Oh, okay.
There's a little bit of me that worries that the expectation of a new Wallace and Gromit movie is going to be significantly greater than the reality. I'm slightly concerned, like you are, that there's a different voice actor playing Wallace, and I'm slightly concerned that the animation will be too good.
Right.
Because part of the joy of Wallace and Gromit, particularly if you go back to the first three, are things like, I mean, if you remember the first one, if you watch that now, it's astonishing. I don't want to say it's bad, because it isn't, but it's astonishing how quickly it developed. So I'm prepared for crushing disappointment, so I'm going to give it a 7 out of 10. That's my expectation of the movie.
Yeah, I've been rewatching the original 4 in the highly controversial 4K versions.
Oh, are they controversial?
So in the lead up for it, yeah.
Why are they controversial?
They've used AI to enhance them. Apparently that's a controversial thing to do.
Yeah, that does feel like it's a thing you probably shouldn't do. Yeah,
I think it's probably more noticeable if you're looking for it. Okay. Anyway.
Okay, well, there we go. It's very exciting. I'm really looking forward to it. So when we come back, we'll be able to talk about it. I have prepared myself for the Wallace and Gromit movie by popping to the shops and buying some Wallace and Gromit cheese, genuinely, and crackers. And that's how I intend to watch it. There you go.
That's how I'm doing it too, if that helps.
So cheese and crackers, and then we'll come back and watch it. You know that at the end of every episode we do. Do you know what day it is today? Ha ha ha.
Yeah.
Right. Did you know that today in Mexico, it is actually the it sounds like a Wallace and Gromit movie. That's where I'm going with it. So the day in Mexico, it is officially Night of the Radishes.
Wow.
Right. And if the next Wallace and Gromit movie was called Wallace and Gromit and the Night of the Radishes, at no point would you be surprised.
No, that's so convincing.
Yeah, so it is Night of the Radishes in Mexico.
Cool.
There you go. Brilliant. Okay.
It's also Christmas Eve Eve.
It is Christmas Eve Eve. Tomorrow is Christmas Eve, which you've timestamped the episode there really badly.
I know, and it's definitely not going to come out. It might be after Christmas. We never know.
By the time this gets out, it will probably be like January or something.
Yeah.
But it's Christmas. It's Christmas Eve Eve, and so on behalf of Sam and all of us here behind the scenes at the Benefit of Hindsight podcast, we wish you a Merry Christmas.
And happy holidays as well.
Can you say, of course, yeah.
I don't know. I heard a really good one the other day.
Let's hear it.
I can't remember what it was. Oh, that's what it was. I can't remember where I got it from. Compliments of the season.
Compliments of the season.
I loved it. I can't remember where I got it from, and I'd totally forgotten up until this exact moment. So there you go.
Well, Merry Christmas. Happy Hanukkah, whatever you do. Let's hope you have a good one, and we can all hope, I think, for a magnificent new year. But maybe we'll talk about that in our next episode, which will be about Wallace and Gromit. My final question for you then is this: I do have one more question for you. I wonder if you could just put into words, as an adult, Sam, what it means for there to be a brand new Wallace and Gromit movie that you have never seen before. Does that resonate really with you?
It's cool, I guess.
Okay. All right. Are you underplaying that?
Maybe a little bit. I know it's Christmas Day, but I think on the day, I think I'll be a bit more excited to it. But at the moment, honestly, if I'm being completely truthful, I'm avoiding it.
Yeah.
Because I know there's loads of Blue Peter things and behind-the-scenes Netflix things about it coming out, and I'm trying to avoid it because I want to go in as fresh as possible.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
So obviously I've seen the trailers that have been on the telly, and they're the BBC Christmas ident at the moment too, so I've seen those. But as far as I'm doing that, I'm kind of trying to avoid it so I can go in completely blind, as blind as I can be. I am looking forward to it.
It feels like the kind of thing, like, I'm trying to think of what would be a kind of a near equivalent for me.
Like if they released an anime of Lord of the Rings in the cinema. We haven't talked about that.
No, I think that's another one for the benefit of foresight when we get there.
Yeah.
Because I've seen some of the reviews and I'm not sure whether or not that's I don't know. So I don't know how I feel about all the Tolkien stuff. But if they said Peter Jackson and the New Line have finally relented and they're going to allow him to release the 5-hour versions of each movie, I'd probably be pretty happy about that. So
yeah, me too.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks very much for sticking with us. This is the last podcast of 2024. The next time you hear from us, it will be 2025. Wow.
Yeah.
So we wish you all the best, compliments of the season, and and if you are going to go and watch Wallace and Gromit, enjoy that too. And we'll be back very soon. So that's all there is from us. And enjoy Night of the Radishes if you're joining us from Mexico. Goodbye from me.
And goodbye from me.
Bye-bye then. Bye.
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 Compliments of the season.
Compliments of the season.
Of hindsight, we'll see, were the movies truly awful, or did they change history?